Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. What You Pawn, I Will Redeem by Sherman Alexie. Noon. One day you have a home and the next you don't, but I'm not going to tell you my particular reasons for being homeless, because it's my secret story, and Indians have to work hard to keep secrets from hungry white folks. I'm a Spokane Indian boy, an interior Salish, and my people have lived within a 100-mile radius of Spokane, Washington, for at least 10,000 years. I grew up in Spokane, moved to Seattle 23 years ago for college, flunked out after 2 semesters, worked various blue and bluer-collar jobs, married 2 or 3 times, fathered 2 or 3 kids, and then went crazy. Of course, crazy is not the official definition of my mental problem, but I don't think a social disorder fits it either, because that makes me sound like I'm a serial killer or something. I've never hurt another human being, or at least not physically. I've broken a few hearts in my time, but we've all done that, so I'm nothing special in that regard. I'm a boring heartbreaker, too. I never dated or married more than 1 woman at a time. I didn't break hearts into pieces overnight. I broke them slowly and carefully. And I didn't set any land speed records running out the door. Piece by piece, I disappeared. I've been disappearing ever since. I've been homeless for 6 years now. If there's such a thing as an effective homeless man, then I suppose I'm effective. Being homeless is probably the only thing I've ever been good at. I know where to get the best free food. I've made friends with restaurant and convenience store managers who let me use their bathrooms. And I don't mean the public bathrooms either. I mean the employees' bathrooms, the clean ones hidden behind the kitchen or the pantry or the cooler. I know it sounds strange to be proud of this, but it means a lot to me, being trustworthy enough to piss in somebody else's clean bathroom. Maybe you don't understand the value of a clean bathroom, but I do. Probably none of this interests you. Homeless Indians are everywhere in Seattle. We're common and boring, and you walk right on by us with maybe a look of anger or disgust or even sadness at the terrible fate of the noble savage. But we have dreams and families. I'm friends with a homeless Plains Indian man whose son is the editor of a big-time newspaper back east. Of course, that's his story, but we Indians are great storytellers and liars and myth-makers. So maybe that Plains Indian hobo is just a plain old everyday Indian. I'm kind of suspicious of him because he identifies himself only as Plains Indian, a generic term, and not by a specific tribe. When I asked him why he wouldn't tell me exactly what he is, he said, "Do any of us know exactly what we are?" "Yeah, great, a philosophizing Indian." "Hey," I said, "you gotta have a home to be that homely." He just laughed and flipped me the eagle and walked away. I wander the streets with a regular crew, my teammates, my defenders, my posse. It's Joseph Sharon, Jr., and me. We matter to one another if we don't matter to anybody else. Joseph Sharon is a big woman, about 7 feet tall if you're measuring overall effect, and about 5 feet tall if you're only talking about the physical. She's a Yakima Indian of the Wishram variety. Junior is a Colville, but there are about 199 tribes that make up the Colville, so he could be anything. He's good-looking, though, like he just stepped out of some don't-litter-the-earth public service advertisement. He's got those great big cheekbones that are like planets, you know, with little moons orbiting them. He gets me jealous, jealous, and jealous. If you put Junior and me next to each other, he's the before-Columbus-arrived Indian, and I'm the after-Columbus-arrived Indian. I am living proof of the horrible damage that colonialism has done to us skins. But I'm not going to let you know how scared I sometimes get of history and its ways. I'm a strong man, and I know that silence is the best method of dealing with white folks. This whole story really started at lunchtime, when Joseph Sharon, Jr. and I were panning the handle down at Pike Place Market. After about 2 hours of negotiating, we earned $5, good enough for a bottle of fortified courage from the most beautiful 7-Eleven in the world. So we headed over that way, feeling like warrior drunks, and we walked past this pawn shop I'd never noticed before. And that was strange, because we Indians have built-in pawn shop radar. But the strangest thing of all was the old powwow dance regalia I saw hanging in the window. "That's my grandmother's regalia," I said to Rose of Sharon and Junior. "How you know for sure?" Junior asked. I didn't know for sure, because I hadn't seen that regalia in person ever. I'd only seen photographs of my grandmother dancing in it, and those were taken before somebody stole it from her 50 years ago. But it sure looked like my memory of it, and it had all the same color feathers and beads that my family sewed into our powwow regalia. "There's only one way to know for sure," I said. So Rose of Sharon, Junior, and I walked into the pawn shop and greeted the old white man working behind the counter. "How can I help you?" he asked. "That's my grandmother's powwow regalia in your window," I said. "Somebody stole it from her 50 years ago, and my family has been searching for it ever since." The pawnbroker looked at me like I was a liar. I understood. Pawn shops are filled with liars. "I'm not lying," I said. "Ask my friends here. They'll tell you." "He's the most honest Indian I know," Rose of Sharon said. "All right, honest Indian," the pawnbroker said. "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Can you prove it's your grandmother's regalia?" "Because they don't want to be perfect, because only God is perfect, Indian people sew flaws into their powwow regalia. My family always sewed one yellow bead somewhere on our regalia, but we always hid it so that you had to search really hard to find it." "If it really is my grandmother's," I said, "there will be one yellow bead hidden somewhere on it." "All right, then," the pawnbroker said. "Let's take a look." He pulled the regalia out of the window, laid it down on the glass counter, and we searched for that yellow bead and found it hidden beneath the armpit. "There it is," the pawnbroker said. He didn't sound surprised. "You were right. This is your grandmother's regalia." "It's been missing for 50 years, Junior said. "Hey, Junior," I said, "it's my family's story. Let me tell it." "All right," he said. "I apologize. You go ahead." "It's been missing for 50 years, I said. "That's his family's sad story," Rose of Sharon said. "Are you going to give it back to him?" "That would be the right thing to do," the pawnbroker said, "but I can't afford to do the right thing. I paid $1,000 for this. I can't just give away $1,000. "We could go to the cops and tell them it was stolen," Rose of Sharon said. "Hey," I said to her, "don't go threatening people." The pawnbroker sighed. He was thinking about the possibilities. "Well, I suppose you could go to the cops," he said, "but I don't think they'd believe a word you said." He sounded sad about that, as if he was sorry for taking advantage of our disadvantages. "What's your name?" the pawnbroker asked me. "Jackson," I said. "Is that first or last?" "Both," I said. "Are you serious?" "Yes, it's true. My mother and father named me Jackson Jackson. My family nickname is Jackson Squared. My family is funny." "All right, Jackson Jackson," the pawnbroker said. "You wouldn't happen to have $1,000, would you?" "We've got $5 total," I said. "That's too bad," he said, and thought hard about the possibilities. "I'd sell it to you for $1,000 if you had it. Heck, to make it fair, I'd sell it to you for $999. I'd lose a dollar. That would be the moral thing to do in this case. To lose a dollar would be the right thing." "We've got $5 total," I said again. "That's too bad," he said once more, and thought harder about the possibilities. "How about this? I'll give you 24 hours to come up with $999. You come back here at lunchtime tomorrow with the money, and I'll sell it back to you. How does that sound?" "It sounds all right," I said. "All right, then," he said. "We have a deal, and I'll get you started. Here's $20. He opened up his wallet and pulled out a crisp $20 bill and gave it to me, and Rose of Sharon, Junior, and I walked out into the daylight to search for $974 more. 1 p.m. Rose of Sharon, Junior, and I carried our $20 bill and our $5 in loose change over to the 7-Eleven and bought 3 bottles of Imagination. We needed to figure out how to raise all that money in only one day. Thinking hard, we huddled in an alley beneath the Alaska Way Viaduct and finished off those bottles. 1, 2, and 3. 2 p.m. Rose of Sharon was gone when I woke up. I heard later that she had hitchhiked back to Toppenish and was living with her sister on the reservation. Junior had passed out beside me and was covered in his own vomit, or maybe somebody else's vomit, and my head hurt from thinking, so I left him alone and walked down to the water. I love the smell of ocean water. Salt always smells like memory. When I got to the wharf, I ran into 3 Aleut cousins, who sat on a wooden bench and stared out at the bay and cried. Most of the homeless Indians in Seattle come from Alaska. One by one, each of them hopped a big working boat in Anchorage or Barrow or Juneau, fished his way south to Seattle, jumped off the boat with a pocketful of cash to party hard at one of the highly sacred and traditional Indian bars, went broke and broker, and has been trying to find his way back to the boat in the frozen north ever since. These Aleuts smelled like salmon, I thought, and they told me they were going to sit on that wooden bench until their boat came back. "How long has your boat been gone?" I asked. 11 years, the elder Aleut said. I cried with them for a while. "Hey," I said, "do you guys have any money I can borrow?" They didn't. 3 p.m. I walked back to Junior. He was still out cold. I put my face down near his mouth to make sure he was breathing. He was alive, so I dug around in his blue jeans pockets and found half a cigarette. I smoked it all the way down and thought about my grandmother. Her name was Agnes, and she died of breast cancer when I was 14. My father always thought Agnes caught her tumors from the uranium mine on the reservation. But my mother said the disease started when Agnes was walking back from a powwow one night and got run over by a motorcycle. She broke 3 ribs, and my mother always said those ribs never healed right, and tumors take over when you don't heal right. Sitting beside Junior, smelling the smoke and the salt and the vomit, I wondered if my grandmother's cancer started when somebody stole her powwow regalia. Maybe the cancer started in her broken heart and then leaked out into her breasts. I know it's crazy, but I wondered whether I could bring my grandmother back to life if I bought back her regalia. I needed money, big money, so I left Junior and walked over to the Real Change office. 4 p.m. Real Change is a multifaceted organization that publishes a newspaper, supports cultural projects that empower the poor and the homeless, and mobilizes the public around poverty issues. Real Change's mission is to organize, educate, and build alliances to create solutions to homelessness and poverty. It exists to provide a voice for poor people in our community. I memorize Real Change's mission statement because I sometimes sell the newspaper on the streets. But you have to stay sober to sell it, and I'm not always good at staying sober. Anybody can sell the paper. You buy each copy for 30 cents and sell it for a dollar, and you keep the profit. I need 1,430 papers, I said to the big boss. That's a strange number, he said, and that's a lot of papers. I need them. The big boss pulled out his calculator and did the math. It will cost you $429 for that many, he said. If I had that kind of money, I wouldn't need to sell the papers. What's going on, Jackson to the second power, he asked. He's the only person who calls me that. He's a funny and kind man. I told him about my grandmother's powwow regalia and how much money I needed in order to buy it back. We should call the police, he said. I don't want to do that, I said. It's a quest now. I need to win it back by myself. I understand, he said, and to be honest, I'd give you the papers to sell if I thought it would work. But the record for the most papers sold in one day by one vendor is only 302. That would net me about $200, I said. The big boss used his calculator. $211.40, he said. That's not enough, I said. And the most money anybody has made in one day is $525, and that's because somebody gave Old Blue $500 bills for some dang reason. The average daily net is about $30. This isn't going to work. No. Can you lend me some money? I can't do that, he said. If I lend you money, I have to lend money to everybody. What can you do? I'll give you 50 papers for free, but don't tell anybody I did it. Okay, I said. He gathered up the newspapers and handed them to me. I held them to my chest. He hugged me. I carried the newspapers back toward the water. 5 p.m. Back on the wharf, I stood near the Bainbridge Island Terminal and tried to sell papers to business commuters boarding the ferry. I sold 5 in 1 hour, dumped the other 45 in a garbage can, and walked into McDonald's. Ordered 4 cheeseburgers for $1 each and slowly ate them. After eating, I walked outside and vomited on the sidewalk. I hated to lose my food so soon after eating it. As an alcoholic Indian with a busted stomach, I always hope I can keep enough food in me to stay alive. 6 p.m. With $1 in my pocket, I walked back to Junior. He was still passed out, and I put my ear to his chest and listened for his heartbeat. He was alive, so I took off his shoes and socks and found $1 in his left sock and 50 cents in his right sock. With $2.50 in my hand, I sat beside Junior and thought about my grandmother and her stories. When I was 13, my grandmother told me a story about the Second World War. She was a nurse at a military hospital in Sydney, Australia. For 2 years, she healed and comforted American and Australian soldiers. One day, she tended to a wounded Maori soldier who had lost his legs to an artillery attack. He was very dark-skinned. His hair was black and curly, and his eyes were black and warm. His face was covered with bright tattoos. "Are you Maori?" he asked my grandmother. "No," she said. "I'm Spokane Indian, from the United States." "Ah, yes," he said. "I have heard of your tribes, but you are the first American Indian I've ever met." "There's a lot of Indian soldiers fighting for the United States," she said. "I have a brother fighting in Germany, and I lost another brother on Okinawa." "I am sorry," he said. "I was on Okinawa as well. It was terrible." "I am sorry about your legs," my grandmother said. "It's funny, isn't it?" he said. "What's funny?" "How we brown people are killing other brown people so white people will remain free." "I hadn't thought of it that way." "Well, sometimes I think of it that way, and other times I think of it the way they want me to think of it. I get confused." She fed him morphine. "Do you believe in heaven?" he asked. "Which heaven?" she asked. "I'm talking about the heaven where my legs are waiting for me." They laughed. "Of course," he said. "My legs will probably run away from me when I get to heaven, and how will I ever catch them?" "You have to get your arms strong," my grandmother said, "so you can run on your hands." They laughed again. Sitting beside Junior, I laughed at the memory of my grandmother's story. I put my hand close to Junior's mouth to make sure he was still breathing. Yes, Junior was alive, so I took my $2.50 and walked to the Korean grocery store in Pioneer Square. 7 p.m. At the Korean grocery store, I bought a 50-cent cigar and 2 scratch lottery tickets for $1 each. The maximum cash prize was $500 a ticket. If I won both, I would have enough money to buy back the regalia. I loved Mary, the young Korean woman who worked the register. She was the daughter of the owners, and she sang all day. "I love you," I said when I handed her the money. "You always say you love me," she said. "That's because I will always love you. You are a sentimental fool. I'm a romantic old man. Too old for me." "I know I'm too old for you, but I can dream." "Okay," she said. "I agreed to be part of your dreams, but I will only hold your hand in your dreams. No kissing and no sex. Not even in your dreams." "Okay," I said. "No sex, just romance." "Goodbye, Jackson Jackson, my love. I will see you soon." I left the store, walked over to Occidental Park, sat on a bench, and smoked my cigar all the way down. 10 minutes after I finished the cigar, I scratched my first lottery ticket and won nothing. I could win only $500 now, and that would be only half of what I needed. 10 minutes after I lost, I scratched the other ticket and won a free ticket, a small consolation and one more chance to win some money. I walked back to Mary. "Jackson, Jackson," she said, "have you come back to claim my heart?" "I won a free ticket," I said. "Just like a man," she said. "You love money and power more than you love me." "It's true," I said, "and I'm sorry it's true." She gave me another scratch ticket, and I took it outside. I like to scratch my tickets in private. Hopeful and sad, I scratched that third ticket and won real money. I carried it back inside to Mary. "I won $100, I said. She examined the ticket and laughed. "That's a fortune," she said, and counted out 5 20s. Our fingertips touched as she handed me the money. I felt electric and constant. "Thank you," I said, and gave her one of the bills. "I can't take that," she said. "It's your money." "No, it's tribal. It's an Indian thing. When you win, you're supposed to share with your family." "I'm not your family." "Yes, you are." She smiled. She kept the money. With $80 in my pocket, I said goodbye to my dear Mary and walked out into the cold night air. 8 p.m. I wanted to share the good news with Junior. I walked back to him, but he was gone. I heard later that he had hitchhiked down to Portland, Oregon, and died of exposure in an alley behind the Hilton Hotel. 9 p.m. Lonesome for Indians, I carried my $80 over to Big Hearts in South Downtown. Big Hearts is an all-Indian bar. Nobody knows how or why Indians migrate to one bar and turn it into an official Indian bar. But Big Hearts has been an Indian bar for 23 years. It used to be way up on Aurora Avenue, but a crazy Lummi Indian burned that one down and the owners moved to the new location a few blocks south of Safeco Field. I walked into Big Hearts and counted 15 Indians, 8 men and 7 women. I didn't know any of them, but Indians like to belong, so we all pretended to be cousins. "How much for whiskey shots?" I asked the bartender, a fat white guy. "You want the bad stuff or the badder stuff?" "As bad as you got. $1 a shot." I laid my $80 on the bar top. "All right," I said. "Me and my cousins here are going to be drinking 80 shots. How many is that apiece?" "Counting you," a woman shouted from behind me. "That's 5 shots for everybody." I turned to look at her. She was a chubby and pale Indian woman sitting with a tall and skinny Indian man. "All right, math genius," I said to her, and then shouted for the whole bar to hear. 5 drinks for everybody." All the other Indians rushed the bar, and I sat with the mathematician and her skinny friend. We took our time with our whiskey shots. "What's your tribe?" I asked. "I'm Duwamish," she said, "and he's Crow." "You're a long way from Montana," I said to him. "I'm Crow," he said. "I flew here." "What's your name?" I asked them. "I'm Irene Muse," she said, "and this is Honey Boy." She shook my hand hard, but he offered his hand as if I was supposed to kiss it. So I did. He giggled and blushed as much as a dark-skinned crow can blush. "You're one of them two-spirits, aren't you?" I asked him. "I love women," he said, "and I love men." "Sometimes both at the same time," Irene said. We laughed. "Man," I said to Honey Boy, "so you must have about 8 or 9 spirits going on inside you, isn't it?" "Sweetie," he said, "I'll be whatever you want me to be." "Oh, no," Irene said. "Honey Boy is falling in love." "It has nothing to do with love," he said. We laughed. "Wow," I said, "I'm flattered, Honey Boy, but I don't play on your team." "Never say never," he said. "You better be careful," Irene said. "Honey Boy knows all sorts of magic." "Honey Boy," I said, "you can try to seduce me, but my heart belongs to a woman named Mary." "Is your Mary a virgin?" Honey Boy asked. We laughed. And we drank our whiskey shots until they were gone. But the other Indians bought me more whiskey shots because I'd been so generous with my money. And Honey Boy pulled out his credit card, and I drank and sailed on that plastic boat. After 12 shots, I asked Irene to dance. She refused, but Honey Boy shuffled over to the jukebox, dropped in a quarter, and selected Willie Nelson's "Help Me Make It Through the Night." As Irene and I sat at the table and laughed and drank more whiskey, Honey Boy danced a slow circle around us and sang along with Willie. "Are you serenading me?" I asked him. He kept singing and dancing. "Are you serenading me?" I asked him again. "He's going to put a spell on you," Irene said. I leaned over the table, spilling a few drinks, and kissed Irene hard. She kissed me back. 10 p.m. Irene pushed me into the woman's bathroom, into a stall, shut the door behind us, and shoved her hand down my pants. She was short, so I had to lean over to kiss her. I grabbed and squeezed her everywhere I could reach, and she was wonderfully fat, and every part of her body felt like a large, warm, soft breast. Midnight. Nearly blind with alcohol, I stood alone at the bar and swore I had been standing in the bathroom with Irene only a minute ago. "One more shot," I yelled at the bartender. "You've got no more money," he yelled back. "Somebody buy me a drink," I shouted. "They've got no more money. Where are Irene and Honey Boy?" "Long gone." 2 a.m. "Closing time," the bartender shouted at the 3 or 4 Indians who were still drinking hard after a long, hard day of drinking. Indian alcoholics are either sprinters or marathoners. "Where are Irene and Honey Boy?" I asked. "They've been gone for hours," the bartender said. "Where'd they go?" "I told you 100 times I don't know." "What am I supposed to do?" "It's closing time. I don't care where you go, but you're not staying here." "You are an ungrateful bastard. I've been good to you." "You don't leave right now, I'm going to kick your ass." "Come on, I know how to fight." He came at me. I don't remember what happened after that. 4 a.m. I emerged from the blackness and discovered myself walking behind a big warehouse. I didn't know where I was. My face hurt. I felt my nose and decided that it might be broken. Exhausted and cold, I pulled a plastic tarp from a truck bed, wrapped it around me like a faithful lover, and fell asleep in the dirt. 6 a.m. Somebody kicked me in the ribs. I opened my eyes and looked up at a white cop. "Jackson," the cop said, "is that you?" "Officer Williams," I said. He was a good cop with a sweet tooth. He'd given me hundreds of candy bars over the years. I wonder if he knew I was diabetic. "What the hell are you doing here?" he asked. "I was cold and sleepy," I said, "so I lay down." "You dumbass, you passed out on the railroad tracks." I sat up and looked around. I was lying on the railroad tracks. Dock workers stared at me. I should have been a railroad track pizza, a double Indian pepperoni with extra cheese. Sick and scared, I leaned over and puked whiskey. "What the hell's wrong with you?" Officer Williams asked. "You've never been this stupid." "It's my grandmother," I said. "She died." "I'm sorry, man," he said. "When did she die?" 1972. "And you're killing yourself now?" "I've been killing myself ever since she died." He shook his head. He was sad for me. Like I said, he was a good cop. "And somebody beat the hell out of you," he said. "You remember who?" "Mr. Grief and I went a few rounds." "It looks like Mr. Grief knocked you out." "Mr. Grief always wins." "Come on," he said. "Let's get you out of here." He helped me and led me over to his squad car. He put me in the back. "You throw up in there and you're cleaning it up," he said. "That's fair." He walked around the car and sat in the driver's seat. "I'm taking you over to detox," he said. "No, man, that place is awful," I said. "It's full of drunk Indians." We laughed. He drove away from the docks. "I don't know how you guys do it," he said. "What guys?" I asked. "You Indians. How the hell do you laugh so much? I just picked your ass off the railroad tracks and you're making jokes. Why the hell do you do that?" "The two funniest tribes I've ever been around are Indians and Jews, so I guess that says something about the inherent humor of genocide." We laughed. "Listen to you, Jackson. You're so smart. Why the hell are you on the street?" "Give me $1,000 and I'll tell you." "You bet I'd give you $1,000 if I knew you'd straighten up your life." He meant it. He was the second best cop I've ever known. "You're a good cop," I said. "Come on, Jackson," he said. "Don't blow smoke up my ass." "No, really, you remind me of my grandfather." "Yeah, that's what you Indians always tell me." "No, man, my grandfather was a tribal cop. He was a good cop. He never arrested people. He took care of them, just like you." "I've arrested hundreds of scumbags, Jackson, and I've shot a couple in the ass." "It don't matter, you're not a killer." "I didn't kill them, I killed their asses. I'm an ass killer." We drove through downtown. The missions and shelters had already released their overnighters. Sleepy homeless men and women stood on street corners and stared up at a gray sky. It was the morning after the night of the living dead. "Do you ever get scared?" I asked Officer Williams. "What do you mean?" "I mean, being a cop, is it scary?" He thought about that for a while. He contemplated it. I liked that about him. "I guess I try not to think too much about being afraid," he said. "If you think about fear, then you'll be afraid. The job is boring most of the time. Just driving and looking into dark corners, you know, and seeing nothing. But then things get heavy. You're chasing somebody or fighting them or walking around a dark house, and you just know some crazy guy is hiding around a corner. And hell yes, it's scary." "My grandfather was killed in the line of duty," I said. "I'm sorry, how did it happen?" I knew he'd listened closely to my story. "He worked on the reservation. Everybody knew everybody. It was safe. We aren't like those crazy Sioux or Apache or any of those other warrior tribes. They've only been 3 murders on my reservation in the last 100 years. "That is safe." "Yeah, we Spokane, we're passive, you know. We're mean with words and we'll cuss out anybody. But we don't shoot people or stab them. Not much, anyway." "So what happened to your grandfather?" "This man and his girlfriend were fighting down by Little Falls." "Domestic dispute. Those are the worst." "Yeah, but this guy was my grandfather's brother, my great-uncle." "Oh, no." "Yeah, it was awful. My grandfather just strolled into the house. He'd been there 1,000 times. And his brother and his girlfriend were drunk and beating on each other. And my grandfather stepped between them just as he'd done 100 times before. And the girlfriend tripped or something. She fell down and hit her head and started crying. And my grandfather kneeled down beside her to make sure she was all right. And for some reason, my great-uncle reached down, pulled my grandfather's pistol out of the holster, and shot him in the head." "That's terrible. I'm sorry." "Yeah, my great-uncle could never figure out why he did it. He went to prison forever, you know, and he always wrote these long letters. like 50 pages of tiny little handwriting, and he was always trying to figure out why he did it. He'd write and write and write and try to figure it out. He never did. It's a great big mystery. Do you remember your grandfather? A little bit. I remember the funeral. My grandmother wouldn't let them bury him. My father had to drag her away from the grave. I don't know what to say. I don't either. We stopped in front of the detox center. We're here, Officer Williams said. I can't go in there, I said. You have to. Please, no, they'll keep me for 24 hours, and then it will be too late. Too late for what? I told him about my grandmother's regalia and the deadline for buying it back. If it was stolen, you need to file a report, he said. I'll investigate it myself. If that thing is really your grandmother's, I'll get it back for you, legally. No, I said, that's not fair. The pawnbroker didn't know it was stolen. And besides, I'm on a mission here. I want to be a hero, you know. I want to win it back like a knight. That's romantic crap. That may be, but I care about it. It's been a long time since I really cared about something. Officer Williams turned around in his seat and stared at me. He studied me. I'll give you some money, he said. I don't have much, only $30. I'm short until payday. And it's not enough to get back the regalia, but it's something. I'll take it, I said. I'm giving it to you because I believe in what you believe. I'm hoping, and I don't know why I'm hoping it, but I hope you can turn $30 into $1,000 somehow. I believe in magic. I believe you'll take my money and get drunk on it. Then why are you giving it to me? There ain't no such thing as an atheist cop. Sure there is. Yeah, well, I'm not an atheist cop. He let me out of the car, handed me 2 fivers and a 20, and shook my hand. Take care of yourself, Jackson, he said. Stay off the railroad tracks. I'll try, I said. He drove away. Carrying my money, I headed back toward the water. 8 a.m. On the wharf, those three Aleuts still waited on the wooden bench. Have you seen your ship? I asked. Seen a lot of ships, the elder Aleut said, but not our ship. I sat on the bench with them. We sat in silence for a long time. I wondered if we would fossilize if we sat there long enough. I thought about my grandmother. I'd never seen her dance in her regalia. And more than anything, I wish I'd seen her dance at a powwow. Do you guys know any songs? I asked the Aleuts. I know all of Hank Williams, the elder Aleut said. How about Indian songs? Hank Williams is Indian. How about sacred songs? Hank Williams is sacred. I'm talking about ceremonial songs, you know, religious ones, the songs you sing back home when you're wishing and hoping. What are you wishing and hoping for? I'm wishing my grandmother was still alive. Every song I know is about that. Well, sing me as many as you can. The Aleuts sang their strange and beautiful songs. I listened. They sang about my grandmother and about their grandmothers. They were lonesome for the cold and the snow. I was lonesome for everything. 10 a.m. After the Aleuts finished their last song, we sat in silence for a while. Indians are good at silence. Was that the last song? I asked. We sang all the ones we could, the elder Aleut said. The others are just for our people. I understood. We Indians have to keep our secrets, and these Aleuts were so secretive they didn't refer to themselves as Indians. Are you guys hungry? I asked. They looked at one another and communicated without talking. We could eat, the elder Aleut said. 11 a.m. The Aleuts and I walked over to the big kitchen, a greasy diner in the International District. I knew they served homeless Indians who lucked into money. 4 for breakfast? The waitress asked when we stepped inside. Yes, we're very hungry, the elder Aleut said. She took us to a booth near the kitchen. I could smell the food cooking. My stomach growled. You guys want separate checks? The waitress asked. No, I'm paying, I said. Aren't you the generous one? She said. Don't do that, I said. Do what? She asked. Don't ask me rhetorical questions. They scare me. She looked puzzled, and then she laughed. Okay, Professor, she said. I'll only ask you real questions from now on. Thank you. What do you guys want to eat? That's the best question anybody can ask anybody, I said. What have you got? How much money you got? She asked. Another good question, I said. I've got $25 I can spend. Bring us all the breakfast you can, plus your tip. She knew the math. All right, that's 4 specials and 4 coffees and 15% for me. The Aleuts and I waited in silence. Soon enough, the waitress returned and poured us 4 coffees, and we sipped at them until she returned again with 4 plates of food. Eggs, bacon, toast, hash brown potatoes. It's amazing how much food you can buy for so little money. Grateful, we feasted. Noon. I said farewell to the Aleuts and walked toward the pawn shop. I heard later that the Aleuts had waded into the salt water near Dock 47 and disappeared. Some Indians swore that they had walked on the water and headed north. Other Indians saw the Aleuts drown. I don't know what happened to them. I looked for the pawn shop and couldn't find it. I swear it wasn't in the place where it had been before. I walked 20 or 30 blocks looking for the pawn shop, turned corners and bisected intersections, and looked up its name in the phone books and asked people walking past me if they'd ever heard of it. But that pawn shop seemed to have sailed away like a ghost ship. I wanted to cry. And just when I'd given up, when I turned one last corner and thought I might die if I didn't find that pawn shop, there it was, in a space I swear it hadn't occupied a few minutes ago. I walked inside and greeted the pawnbroker, who looked a little younger than he had before. "It's you," he said. "Yes, it's me," I said. "Jackson Jackson. That is my name. Where are your friends?" "They went traveling, but it's okay. Indians are everywhere." "Do you have the money?" "How much do you need again?" I asked, and hoped the price had changed. $999. It was still the same price. Of course it was still the same price. Why would it change? "I don't have that," I said. "What do you have?" $5. I set the crumpled Lincoln on the countertop. The pawnbroker studied it. "Is that the same $5 from yesterday?" "No, it's different." He thought about the possibilities. "Did you work hard for this money?" he asked. "Yes," I said. He closed his eyes and thought harder about the possibilities. Then he stepped into the back room and returned with my grandmother's regalia. "Take it," he said, and held it out to me. "I don't have the money. I don't want your money. But I wanted to win it." "You did win it. Now take it before I change my mind." "Do you know how many good men live in this world? Too many to count." I took my grandmother's regalia and walked outside. I knew that solitary yellow bead was part of me. I knew I was that yellow bead in part. Outside, I wrapped myself in my grandmother's regalia and breathed her in. I stepped off the sidewalk and into the intersection. Pedestrians stopped. Cars stopped. The city stopped. They all watched me dance with my grandmother. I was my grandmother, dancing. And that story was What You Pawn, I Will Redeem by Sherman Alexie from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is also from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. I Stand Here Ironing by Tilly Olson. I stand here ironing, and what you asked of me moves tormented back and forth with the iron. I wish you would manage the time to come in and talk with me about your daughter. I'm sure you can help me understand her. She's a youngster who needs help and whom I'm deeply interested in helping. Who needs help? Even if I came, what good would it do? You think because I'm her mother I have a key, or that in some way you could use me as a key? She has lived for 19 years. There is all that life that has happened outside of me, beyond me. And when is there time to remember, to sift, to weigh, to estimate, to total? I will start and there will be an interruption and I will have to gather it all together again. Or I will become engulfed with all I did or did not do, with what should have been and what cannot be helped. She was a beautiful baby, the first and only one of our 5 that was beautiful at birth. You do not guess how new and uneasy her tenancy in her now loveliness. You did not know her all those years she was thought homely, or see her poring over her baby pictures, making me tell her over and over how beautiful she had been, and would be, I would tell her, and was now to the seeing eye. But the seeing eyes were few or non-existent, including mine. I nursed her. They feel that's important nowadays. I nursed all the children, but with her, with all the fierce rigidity of first motherhood. I did like the book said. Though her cries battered me to trembling and my breast ached with swollenness, I waited till the clock decreed. Why do I put that first? I do not even know if it matters or if it explains anything. She was a beautiful baby. She blew shining bubbles of sound. She loved motion, loved light, loved color and music and textures. She would lie on the floor in her blue overalls, patting the surface so hard in ecstasy her hands and feet would blur. She was a miracle to me, but when she was 8 months old, I had to leave her daytimes with the woman downstairs to whom she was no miracle at all, for I worked or looked for work, and for Emily's father, who could no longer endure, he wrote in his goodbye note, sharing want with us. I was 19. It was the pre-relief, pre-WPA world of the Depression. I would start running as soon as I got off the streetcar, running up the stairs, the place smelling sour, and awake or asleep to startle awake. When she saw me, she would break into a clogged weeping that could not be comforted, a weeping I can hear yet. After a while, I found a job hashing at night so I could be with her in the days, and it was better. But it came to where I had to bring her to his family and leave her. It took a long time to raise the money for her fare back. Then she got chicken pox, and I had to wait longer. When she finally came, I hardly knew her, walking quick and nervous like her father, looking like her father, thin and dressed in a shoddy red that yellowed her skin and glared at the pockmarks. All the baby loveliness gone. She was 2, old enough for nursery school, they said, and I did not know then what I know now. The fatigue of the long day and the lacerations of group life in the kinds of nurseries that are only parking places for children. Except that it would have made no difference if I had known. It was the only place there was. It was the only way we could be together, the only way I could hold a job. And even without knowing, I knew. I knew the teacher that was evil because all these years it has curdled into my memory, the little boy hunched in the corner, her rasp. Why aren't you outside? Because Alvin hits you? That's no reason. Go out, coward. I knew Emily hated it, even if she did not clutch and implore, "Don't go, Mommy," like the other children, mornings. She always had a reason why she should stay home. Mama, you look sick. Mama, I feel sick. Mama, the teachers aren't there today. They're sick. Mama, there was a fire there last night. Mama, it's a holiday today. No school, they told me. But never a direct protest, never rebellion. I think of our others in their 3-4-year-oldness, the explosions, the tempers, the denunciations, the demands, and I feel suddenly ill. I stop the ironing. What in me demanded that goodness in her, and what was the cost to her of such goodness? The old man living in the back once said in his gentle way, "You should smile at Emily more when you look at her." What was in my face when I looked at her? I loved her. There were all the acts of love. It was only with the others I remembered what he said, so that it was the face of joy and not of care or tightness or worry I turned to them, but never to Emily. She does not smile easily, let alone almost always, as her brothers and sisters do. Her face is closed and somber, but when she wants, how fluid. You must have seen it in her pantomimes. You spoke of her rare gift for comedy on the stage that rouses a laughter out of the audience so dear they applaud and applaud and do not want to let her go. Where does it come from, that comedy? There was none of it in her when she came back to me that second time, after I had to send her away again. She had a new daddy now to learn to love, and I think perhaps it was a better time. Except when we left her alone nights, telling ourselves she was old enough. "Can't you go some other time, Mommy, like tomorrow?" she would ask. "Will it be just a little while you'll be gone?" The time we came back, the front door open, the clock on the floor in the hall. She, rigid, awake. It wasn't just a little while. I didn't cry. I called you a little, just 3 times, and then I went downstairs to open the door so you could come faster. The clock talked loud. I threw it away. It scared me what it talked. She said the clock talked loud again that night I went to the hospital to have Susan. She was delirious with the fever that comes before red measles, but she was fully conscious all the week I was gone and the week after we were home when she could not come near the baby or me. She did not get well. She stayed skeleton thin, not wanting to eat, and night after night she had nightmares. She would call for me and I would sleepily call back, "You're all right, darling. Go to sleep. It's just a dream." And if she still called, in a sterner voice, "Now go to sleep, Emily. There's nothing to hurt you." Twice, only twice, when I had to get up for Susan anyhow, I went in to sit with her. Now, when it's too late, as if she would let me hold and comfort her like I do the others, I get up and go to her at her moan or restless stirring. Are you awake? Can I get you something? And the answer is always the same. No, I'm all right. Go back to sleep, mother. They persuaded me at the clinic to send her away to a convalescent home in the country where she can have the kind of food and care you can't manage for her, and you'll be free to concentrate on the new baby. They still send children to that place. I see pictures on the society page of sleek young women planning affairs to raise money for it, or dancing at the affairs, or decorating Easter eggs or filling Christmas stockings for the children. They never have a picture of the children, so I do not know if they still wear those gigantic red bows and the ravaged looks on the every other Sunday, when parents can come visit unless otherwise notified, as we were notified the first 6 weeks. Oh, it's a handsome place, green lawns and tall trees and fluted flower beds. High up on the balconies of each cottage the children stand. The girls in their red bows and white dresses, the boys in white suits and gigantic red ties. The parents stand below shrieking up to be heard, and the children shriek down to be heard, and between them the invisible wall, not to be contaminated by parental germs or physical affection. There was a tiny girl who always stood hand in hand with Emily. Her parents never came. One visit she was gone. They moved her to Rose Cottage, Emily shouted in explanation. They don't like you to love anybody here. She wrote once a week, the labored writing of a 7-year-old. I am fine. How is the baby? If I write my letter nicely, I will have a star. Love. There never was a star. We wrote every other day, letters she could never hold or keep, but only hear read, once. We simply do not have room for children to keep any personal possessions, they patiently explained when we pieced one Sunday's shrieking together to plead how much it would mean to Emily to keep her letters and cards. Each visit she looked frailer. She isn't eating, they told us. They had runny eggs for breakfast or mush with lumps, Emily said later. I'd hold it in my mouth and not swallow. Nothing ever tasted good, just when they had chicken. It took us 8 months to get her released home, and only the fact that she gained back so little of her 7 lost pounds convinced the social worker. I used to try and hold and love her after she came back, but her body would stay stiff, and after a while she'd push away. She ate little. Food sickened her, and I think much of life, too. Oh, she had physical lightness and brightness, twinkling by on skates, bouncing like a ball up and down over the jump rope, skimming over the hill, but these were momentary. She fretted about her appearance, thin and dark and foreign-looking, at a time when every little girl was supposed to look, or thought she should look, like a chubby blonde replica of Shirley Temple. The doorbell sometimes rang for her, but no one seemed to come and play in the house or be a best friend. Maybe because we moved so much. There was a boy she loved painfully through 2 school semesters. Months later, she told me how she had taken pennies from my purse to buy him candy. Licorice was his favorite, and I brought him some every day, but he still liked Jennifer better than me. Why, Mommy, why? A question I could never answer. School was a worry to her. She was not glib or quick in a world where glibness and quickness were easily confused with ability to learn. To her overworked and exasperated teachers, she was an over-conscientious, slow learner who kept trying to catch up and was absent entirely too often. I let her be absent, although sometimes the illness was imaginary. How different from my now strictness about attendance with the others. I wasn't working. We had a new baby. I was home anyhow. Sometimes, after Susan grew old enough, I would keep her home from school, too, to have them all together. Mostly Emily had asthma, and her breathing, harsh and labored, would fill the house with a curiously tranquil sound. I would bring the 2 older dresser mirrors and her boxes of collections to her bed. She would select beads and single earrings, bottle tops and shells, dried flowers and pebbles, old postcards and scraps, all sorts of oddments. Then she and Susan would play Kingdom, setting up landscapes and furniture, peopling them with action. Those were the only times of peaceful companionship between her and Susan. I have edged away from it, that poisonous feeling between them, that terrible balancing of hurts and needs I had to do between them, and did so badly those earlier years. Oh, there are conflicts between the others, too, each one human, needing, demanding, hurting, taking, but only between Emily and Susan, no Emily toward Susan, that corroding resentment. It seems so obvious on the surface, yet it is not obvious. Susan, the second child, Susan, golden and curly-haired and chubby, quick and articulate and assured, everything in appearance and manner Emily was not. Susan, not able to resist Emily's precious things, losing or sometimes clumsily breaking them. Susan telling jokes and riddles to company for applause while Emily sat silent, to say to me later, "That was my riddle, Mother. I told it to Susan." Susan, who, for all the 5 years' difference in age, was just a year behind Emily in developing physically. I am glad for that slow physical development that widened the difference between her and her contemporaries, though she suffered over it. She was too vulnerable for that terrible world of youthful competition, of preening and parading, of constant measuring of yourself against every other, of envy. If I had that copper hair, or if I had that skin, she tormented herself enough about not looking like the others. There was enough of unsureness, the having to be conscious of words before you speak, the constant caring, what are they thinking of me, what kind of an impression am I making? There was enough without having it all magnified unendurably by the merciless physical drives. Ronnie is calling. He is wet and I change him. It is rare there is such a cry now. That time of motherhood is almost behind me when the ear is not one's own but must always be racked and listening for the child cry, the child call. We sit for a while and I hold him, looking out over the city spread in charcoal with its soft aisles of light. Shuggily, he breathes. A funny word, a family word, inherited from Emily, invented by her to say comfort. In this and other ways she leaves her seal, I say aloud, and startle at my saying it. What do I mean? What did I start to gather together to try and make coherent? I was at the terrible growing years, war years. I do not remember them well. I was working. There were 4 smaller ones now. There was not time for her. She had to help be a mother and housekeeper and shopper. She had to set her seal. Mornings of crisis and near hysteria, trying to get lunches packed, hair combed, coats and shoes found, everyone to school or childcare on time, the baby ready for transportation, and always the paper scribbled on by a smaller one, the book looked at by Susan, then mislaid, the homework not done, running out to that huge school where she was one. She was lost. She was a drop, suffering over the unpreparedness, stammering and unsure in her classes. There was so little time left at night after the kids were bedded down. She would struggle over books, always eating. It was in those years she developed her enormous appetite that is legendary in our family, and I would be ironing or preparing food for the next day or writing V-mail to Bill or tending the baby. Sometimes to make me laugh, or out of her despair, she would imitate happenings or types at school. I think I said once, "Why don't you do something like this in the school amateur show?" One morning she phoned me at work, hardly understandable through the weeping. "Mother, I did it. I won. I won. They gave me first prize. They clapped and clapped and wouldn't let me go." Now suddenly she was somebody, and as imprisoned in her difference as in anonymity. She began to be asked to perform at other high schools, even in colleges, then at city and statewide affairs. The first one we went to, I only recognized her that first moment when, thin, shy, she almost drowned herself into the curtains. Then, was this Emily? The control, the command, the convulsing and deadly clowning, the spell, then the roaring, stamping audience, unwilling to let this rare and precious laughter out of their lives. Afterwards, "You ought to do something about her with a gift like that, but without money or knowing how, what does one do? We have left it all to her, and the gift has as often eddied inside, clogged and clotted, as been used and growing. She is coming. She runs up the stairs 2 at a time with her light, graceful step, and I know she's happy tonight. Whatever it was that occasioned your call did not happen today. Aren't you ever going to finish the ironing, Mother? Whistler painted his mother in a rocker. I'd have to paint mine standing over an ironing board." This is one of her communicative nights, and she tells me everything and nothing as she fixes herself a plate of food out of the icebox. She's so lovely. "Why did you want me to come in at all? Why were you concerned? She will find her way. She starts up the stairs to bed. Don't get me up with the rest in the morning. But I thought you were having midterms. Oh, those, she comes back in and says quite lightly. In a couple of years when we're all be Adam dead, they won't matter a bit. She has said it before. She believes it. But because I have been dredging the past and all that compounds a human being is so heavy and meaningful in me, I cannot endure it tonight. I will never total it all. I will never come in to say she was a child seldom smiled at. Her father left me before she was a year old. I had to work her first 6 years when there was work, or I sent her home and to his relatives. There were years she had care she hated. She was dark and thin and foreign-looking in a world where the prestige went to blondness and curly hair and dimples. She was slow where glibness was prized. She was a child of anxious, not proud, love. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. I was a young mother. I was a distracted mother. There were the other children pushing up, demanding. Her younger sister was all that she was not. She did not like me to touch her. She kept too much in herself. Her life was such she had to keep too much in herself. My wisdom came too late. She has much to her, and probably nothing will come of it. She is a child of her age, of depression, of war, of fear. Let her be, so all that is in her will not bloom. But in how many does it? There is still enough to live by. Only help her to believe. Help make it so that there's cause for her to believe that she's more than this dress on the ironing board, helpless before the iron. And that story was I Stand Here Ironing by Tilly Olson from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.